Chapter 41. The river sounds were muted by a light mist that hung over the dark water like a diaphanous quilt. The egrets and herons that walked silently along the shorelines, their long curved beaks dipping into the silt for food, were the first to sense something not of their world moving toward them out of the night. It began as a slight tremor through the water that increased to a sudden rush of air and a loud throb that sent the startled birds flapping into the air. The few bystanders strolling the levees after dinner and watching the lights of the boat on the water were startled by the sudden appearance of the monstrous shadow. And then the Leviathan materialized from the mist, with her towering raked bows slicing through the water with incredible ease for an object of such massive proportions. Although her four bronze screws were throttled down to negotiate the sharp bend at Nine Mile Point, she still threw a massive wake that rolled up the levees nearly to the roads running along their crests, crushing small vessels anchored along the shore and sweeping a dozen people into the water. Only after she maneuvered into a straight reach did her engines go on full throttle and thrust her up the river at an incredible rate of speed. Except for a white light on the stub of her once tall foremast and the red and green running lights, the only other illumination was an eerie glow that came from her wheelhouse. No movement could be seen on her decks, and only the occasional flicker of silhouettes on the bridge wings offered any signs of life. For the brief minutes it took for her to pass, she seemed like a colossal dinosaur charging across a shallow lake. Her white superstructure was a shadow in the gloom, her black hull all but invisible. She flew no flag, her only identification the raised letters of her name on the bows and stern. Before the mist shrouded her again, her deck seemed to come to life, as men scurried about setting up weapons stations and arming an array of portable missile launchers against possible attack by American law enforcement. These were not foreign mercenaries or amateur terrorists. Despite their casual clothing, they were an elite team of fighters, ruthless, trained, and disciplined for this mission. If captured alive, they were prepared to commit suicide or die fighting. If the operation went according to plan without interference, they would all be evacuated by helicopters before the ship was scuttled. Captain Hung Chang had been right about the surprise and shock shown by the thousands of spectators lining the waterfront of New Orleans, waiting to welcome the United States. After racing past the all-steel, stern-wheel steamboat called the Natchez 9, he had ordered full speed, watching amused as the great liner left the city behind her stern while crushing a small cabin cruiser and its occupants that had happened to get in the path of her sharp bow. He had laughed when he viewed the faces of the official welcoming committee, consisting of the Louisiana governor, the mayor of New Orleans, and other dignitaries, through his binoculars. They looked absolutely stricken when the United States failed to stop and raced on past the dock where she was to be moored and refurbished with plush rooms, restaurants, gift shops, and gambling tables. For the first 30 miles, a fleet of yachts, outboards, and fishing boats followed in the liner's wake. A Coast Guard cutter also raced in pursuit up the river, along with sheriff and police patrol cars that tore along parallel highways with sirens screaming and red lights flashing. Helicopters from New Orleans television news channels swarmed around the ship, cameras aimed at the grand scene being enacted below. Hung Chang ignored all orders demanding the ship come to a stop. Unable to match the great ship's incredible speed on the straight runs of the river, the private craft and Coast Guard cutter soon fell back. As darkness fell, the first real problem Hung Chang faced was not the narrowing of the shipping channel between New Orleans and Baton Rouge that decreased from 1,000 to 500 feet. He was reasonably safe with the 40-foot depth. Her hull was only 101 feet at its widest point, narrowing considerably toward the waterline. If she could pass through the Panama Canal, Hung Chang reasoned, The 200-foot clearance on either side provided just enough leeway through the tight turns. It was clearing the 6 bridges that spanned the banks of the river that gave him his greatest concern. The spring runoff had added nearly 14 feet to the height of the river, making for a tight passage. The United States narrowly slipped under both the Crescent City Connection bridges and the Huey P. Long Bridge, scraping the lower span with the tops of her towering funnels. The next 2 bridges, the Luling and Gramercy, provided a slim gap of less than 12 feet of space. Only the Sunshine Bridge at Donaldsonville remained, and Hung Chang had carefully calculated the United States could safely pass under with 6 feet to spare. After that, the liner was free of all obstructions on her dash to the Mystic Canal, except for river traffic. A myriad of uneasy thoughts began to fade from Hung Chang's mind. There was no strong wind to push the ship off course. Ming Lin guided the ship through the intricate river bends with practiced mastery. And, most important of all, surprise was on his side. Before the Americans realized what was happening, it would be too late. Hung Chang would have the ship in the precise spot to divert the water through the breach blasted in the levee before he and his crew scuttled the ship and were to be in the air and on their way back to the safety of Sungari and the Sung Lin Star, which was prepared to cast off immediately and head out to sea. The closer the United States steamed to the scuttling point, the more distant such worries became. He felt an unexpected shudder through the deck and tensed, looking quickly at Ming Lin, searching for a sign of an error, a tiny mistake in judgment. All he could detect was a few beads of sweat on the helm master's forehead and a tight set to the lips. Then the decks became placid again, except for the beat of the engines, as they again went to full speed up a straight reach of the river. Hung Chang stood with both legs braced apart. He had never felt such incredible strength from a ship before. 240,000 horsepower, 60,000 each to drive her massive propellers, which in turn hurled her up the river at the incredible speed of 50 miles an hour, speed that Hung Chang could not imagine from a ship under his command. He studied his image in the front storm windows of the bridge and saw a face calm and poised with no stress lines. He smiled as the ship passed a large waterfront home with a tall pole flying the stars and bars of the Confederate flag. Soon, very soon, the flag would no longer be flapping in the wind over the mighty Mississippi, but over a muddy creek. The bridge was strangely quiet. There was no need for Hung Chang to call out orders for course and speed changes. Ming Lin was in complete command of the ship's passage, his hands locked on the wheel, his eyes staring into a large monitor that displayed the vessel and its relation to the river in a 3-dimensional image that was transmitted by infrared cameras mounted on the bow and funnels. Through the medium of digital science, a display across the bottom of the monitor also gave him recommended course deviations and velocity instructions, providing him with far better mastery over the ship's progress than if he had piloted by eye during daylight. "We have a towboat pushing 10 grain barges coming up ahead," announced Ming Lin. Hung Chang picked up the ship's radio phone. "Captain of the towboat approaching St. James Landing, we are overtaking you. We are 1/2 mile behind and will overtake you on the Cantrell Reach, passing on your starboard. We have 100-foot beam and suggest you give us a wide berth." There was no response from the unknown towboat captain, but when the United States turned into Cantrell Reach, Hung Chang could see through his night vision glasses that the towboat was slowly turning to port. Too slowly. The towboat captain had not followed the news from New Orleans, and could never imagine that a giant behemoth, the size of the United States, was bearing down on him at unbelievable speed. "He's not going to make it in time," Ming Lin certified calmly. "Can we slow?" asked Hung Chang. "If we don't pass him on a straight reach, it will be impossible after we enter the next series of bends." "Then it's now or never." Ming Lin nodded. "For us to deviate from our computer-programmed passage might very well imperil the operation." Hung Chang picked up the radio phone. "Captain, please veer away quickly, or we may run you down." The towboat captain's voice came back angrily. "You don't own the river, Charlie Brown. Who the hell do you think you're threatening?" Hung Chang shook his head wearily. "I think you had better look over your stern." The reply came like a choked gasp.
"Jesus! Where did you come from?"
Then the towboat and her barges quickly veered to port. Although the move came in time, the great wash from the superliner, her hull displacing over 40,000 tons of water with her passing, cascaded over the towboat and barges, sweeping them sideways and depositing them high and dry on the bank of the levee. In another 10 minutes the ship rounded Point Homus, named for a tribe of Indians who once lived there, before rushing past the town of Donaldsonville and successfully clearing the Sunshine Bridge. As the lights of the bridge faded around the last bend in the river, Hung Chang allowed himself the luxury of a cup of tea. "Only 12 more miles until we're there," said Ming Lin. His words were not a report, but came as casually as a statement that the weather was mild. 20 minutes, 25 at most. Hung Chang was just finishing his tea when a crewman who was standing watch on the starboard bridge wing leaned through the door of the wheelhouse.
"Aircraft, Captain. Approaching from the north. Sounds like helicopters."
He had hoped for a radar installation, but Chin Chang, knowing the United States was on her final voyage, saw no reason for the added expense.
"Can you tell how many?"
"I count 2 coming straight down the river," replied the crewman, staring through night vision glasses. No need for panic, thought Hung Chang. They were either state law enforcement craft that could do little but issue warnings for the ship to stop, or those chartered by the news media. He raised his night vision glasses and peered upriver. Then the veins in his neck became taut as he recognized the helicopters as belonging to the military. In the same moment, a long row of floodlights blinked on, illuminating the river as brightly as daylight, and he saw a convoy of armored tanks rise from the opposite side of the east levee and train their guns on the river channel where the ship was about to pass. Hung Chang was surprised to see no rocket launchers. Not trained in military weapon systems, he did not recognize the National Guard's older M1A1 tanks with their 105mm guns. But he knew well the damage they were capable of against the unarmored superliner. The 2 helicopters, Sikorsky H-76 Eagles, split apart and flew past the side of the ship on a height even with the upper deck. One slowed and hovered above the stern, while the other circled, drew even with the wheelhouse, and trained a bright spotlight on it. A voice from a loudspeaker boomed above the thump of the rotor blades. "Bring your ship to a halt immediately." Hung Chang gave no orders to comply. The fates had suddenly turned against him. The Americans must have somehow been warned. They knew. Damn them. They knew that Chin Chang intended to destroy the levee and use the superliner as a diverting dam. "Halt immediately," the voice came again. "We are coming aboard to secure your ship." Hung Chang hesitated as he weighed his chances of running the gauntlet. He counted 6 tanks lined up on the levee ahead. Lacking missiles with powerful warheads, the enemy would find the great ship next to impossible to sink by tank gunfire alone. The big engines were well below the waterline and immune to destruction from the surface. He glanced at his watch. Bayou Gula and the Mystic Canal were only 15 minutes away now.
For a moment, he considered stopping the ship and surrendering to the American military. But he was committed. To quit now would mean a loss of face. He would do nothing to dishonor his family. He made the decision to keep going. As if to bind his commitment, one of the Chinese Special Forces team fired an SA-7 Russian-made man-portable infrared homing anti-aircraft missile at the helicopter hovering over the stern. At less than 200 yards, it was impossible to miss, even without the homing system. The missile struck the helicopter's boom behind the fuselage and blasted it off. Horizontal control was lost, and the craft spun crazily in circles before falling into the river and sinking out of sight. But not before the two crewmen and 10 troops inside managed to struggle clear. The men in the second helicopter flying opposite the liner's bridge were not as lucky. The next missile blew it apart in an explosive burst of fire, sending flaming debris and bodies crashing into the dark current of the river, their grave swept clean by the seething wake from the ship's propellers. During the death and destruction, Hung Chang and the Chinese fighting force were unaware of the low-pitched buzzing sound approaching from upriver. Nor did any of them see the two black parachutes that fleetingly hid the stars in the night sky. Every eye was turned toward the menacing guns of the tanks, every mind concentrating on running the gauntlet of devastating fire they knew was about to ravage them. Captain Hung Chang spoke quietly into the ship's phone to the engine room. "Pull ahead, all engines.